So at the end of the day, innovation is key to being a differentiated premium brand and being able to generate alpha returns.
Welcome to What If So What, the podcast where we explore what's possible with digital and discover how to make it real in your business. I'm your host, Jim Hertzfeld, and we get shit done by asking digital leaders the right questions. What if, so what, and most importantly, now what?
Hey, everyone. We're here live with Isaiah Engel, author of The Innovation Casino. Isaiah, welcome to the podcast. Tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit of your background, and what motivated you to write this book.
Hey, good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me here. I am the author of Innovation Casino, and the book is really born of my experiences on both extremes of the innovation spectrum. Starting as an entrepreneur in San Diego, where I was born, where I'm from, I started three companies, one after the other, and did that for about 10 years and learned what it was like to innovate in a startup with no resources. Then I moved to Dallas and then joined a Fortune 500 telecom firm where I innovated there, and I still work there. And I saw the opposite extreme of possibly every resource available in the world, and realized that even with that, there's challenges too, but they're different. And so based on my observations in a startup and in a large telecom firm, I came up with the idea of Innovation Casino to create a way for both startups and large companies to solve innovation problems symbiotically with each other.
So that was an interesting answer, a little unexpected, because I thought when you talked about 180 degree differences between companies, I thought you were going to say something like big and slow moving, but you revealed that there's a lot of resources, which is interesting. It kind of reveals a different problem. You know, I think we run into a lot of organizations that are trying to get that, you know, innovation advantage, right? They and some do it really well, and some are really trying to figure it out. But why do you think innovation is so important to organizations and to their customers in the first place?
That's a great question, Jim. And I approach this from a marketing perspective because I'm a marketing guy. And as a marketer, what you want to do is build enduring growth. And you do that by getting customers who are willing to pay a premium, who are willing to remain loyal, and who are willing to refer their friends, refer other people. In order to do that, by definition, you have to be unique, because why would they pay a premium if you offer this exact same thing as a bunch of other competitors? Why would they remain loyal if they can get a better price? So at the end of the day, innovation is key to being a differentiated premium brand and being able to generate alpha returns, as opposed to just returns that are in line with the market. Alpha returns are where you beat the market. And back to my previous question where I talked about the resources, running a company, from my experience, has been very much about taking resources, whether it's investment capital, employees, whatever, and then generating returns with those resources. So if you want to generate alpha returns, and a large companies are very much in that game, especially if they're public, you really have to have customers who are willing to pay a premium, refer others, and remain loyal.
Right. Well, that's, you know, I think what you're saying is that it's just good business plan, right? Is incorporate an innovation model into the organization. And so why do you think organizations struggle with that? Like, what do you think is holding them back, especially the large ones who are, you know, really maybe sitting on, you know, maybe they're the market leader today, right? Maybe they're just not interested in it, but and they are the leader and they've been there forever and they're in a position of strength. But for the companies that really want to do that, they're already bought into that business case. What's holding them back?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it has to do with human nature. In a startup like my startups, we had no history, no resources, and it was all about making a guess out there, executing your business and hoping that you beat the odds, hoping that you generate that alpha return and, you know, your dreams come true. In a big company, they've already beat the odds. They're already the one in a thousand. I think in my book, Innovation Casino, I actually go through the odds of generating an Inc. 500 company by state, but nationwide, it's 1 in 1,000 companies become an Inc. 5,000 company, which is, you know, 20% returns for 3 years over, I think it's over 2 million in revenue. And whatever that is, 1 in 1,000 do it. A large company has already beat those odds. So why do you want to gamble that and lose out? The other reason is also has to do with human nature. When you get a lot of humans together, large companies have bigger teams than startups. So there's a lot more socialization of ideas that have to happen, and rightly so. But that makes it hard to deliver breakthrough innovation. And what you get in a large company is after your core products have matured, you know, the natural thing is to go and investigate other products that either could be new core products or could drive demand for those core products, like non-core, but like, for instance, an app. An app, the fact that there's apps on an iPhone drives demand for the iPhone. The same thing happens in every industry. There's auxiliary products that drive demand for your core products. And it's tempting when interest rates are low and taxes are low and shareholders just want to see growth. It's tempting to just send internal teams on missions to go and make non-core products. But then what you get is more organizational sprawl. And in a startup, which is the opposite of that, you have the people who can make decisions for the company, the C-suite of that startup, they're more focused in on what that core product is. But in a large company with hundreds and hundreds of products, the C-suite can't get in there and lead the different departments to make big concentrated bets. So you get a lot of people who are trying to go along to get along. You get a lot of people innovating around the edges because no one has the authority to get down in there and say, no, we're going to focus. That's the C-suite. They can't do it if they're distracted. And that's the reason why larger companies struggle to innovate.
I love that. I mean, the human element, right? And I think we've always said this, you know, in the technology world, we've said it's the biggest problems we've had with projects or products is it's rarely the technology, right? It's the concrete sort of hard stuff. It's, you know, adoption, it's understanding, it's empathy for the customer and getting it right. And so the human element is always the variable. Or is actually, someone a long time ago once said to me, the soft stuff is the hard stuff, right? So that's a great one. So you outline, I think you address this uniquely in your book. You outline an approach that large organizations can take to get around these complexities and these and get around the odds, right? And I love the premise of it because I think there's a, you know, traditionally there's just this core, either competitive element or there's some sort of, I had an instructor call this the Moses myth, that there's some figure that is going to come in and just make it happen, right? Part the seas.
Yes.
So tell us about this approach. How does it work? You know, what's the theme of your approach? How do we make it happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what's the way that a large company can focus on innovation without getting bogged down? That was at the premise of the book. And what I found was there are two main things. One is to focus on your core. That means divesting what's non-core, getting it out of there so that your CEO, all the way up to your CEO, can focus on what's core, doubling down, tripling down, and really trying to make what's core be 10 times better, because that's your lead advantage in the market. But as you do that, you still have to account for the things that plug in to the core, especially in a software environment. Like, let's just use the most popular example of all time, the iPhone. Making the iPhone better requires having all the non-core things that go into that iPhone, like all the apps, but Apple doesn't make those apps. So that same model, especially when it comes to AI and all the data that's coming off of legacy industries like rail cars or vehicles or manufacturing, there's a lot of data. There's a lot of AI models you can train. And when it comes to that, that fits really, really well with the financial model that I laid out in my book, where external developers could be building those on top of your core product. So if you're a car manufacturer and you want people to be able to use the data coming off of their cars, instead of standing up an internal team to build a software app, no, make your car and your platform 10 times better and open that up to external parties. That's the premise. So the what if, so what model in this whole thing is, what if you could still care for that non-core innovation without bloating up your organization and distracting your C-suite? So what, you would do that with what I've laid out in the innovation casino, which is taking everything that is non-core and funding it with external companies to go and build those things. And to prove this out to the CFO, I modeled in my book the odds. I took the outside view and I looked at the odds of generating returns from investments in non-core innovation and found that it works a lot like a casino. In a casino, you have two sides of the coin. You have a player and you have the house. A player walks in with limited time and limited money, and they make a few concentrated bets in hopes that they'll be the one in a million, that they will put down a dollar and walk out with $1 million. That's the odds of the startup entrepreneur, but it's also the odds of traditional venture capital, because a startup entrepreneur makes one company, venture capital invests in 20 companies. If you look at the odds of venture capital, it's very much just investing in 20 companies when it's one in a thousand average US that are going to become at least an Inc. 5,000 company. When it's one in a thousand, the odds of generating that are just, you might as well be walking into a casino. So when you increase the number of investments, your odds of generating at least 0 to 3% IRR go almost theoretically, they go up to 100% if you could administer it correctly, and which is another part of the whole thing. But theoretically, if you could take the odds of generating an Inc. 5,000 company from your investments in innovation and spread those out across 2,000 bets, I've modeled that you will recoup all of your money. But so what? Like, who wants to do that? Like, you're not in business to just recoup your money. It's not, you know, an interest-free loan. The purpose of this model is to show a large company how they can basically put money out and get it all back. But the alpha comes from growing demand for their core products. So if you come out with the next iPhone of your industry, which is a software platform, and you want third-party developers to build on that, to generate network effects, to generate market expectations of growth, then you can use the financial model in Innovation Casino to artificially stimulate demand from developers to build stuff on your ecosystem and give you a shot at becoming the dominant platform. Now, once you become the dominant platform, the alpha returns come from your stock price. So what I've modeled is how to take third-party investor money, use it to create a what's called an ecosystem innovation fund, which is just another type of corporate venture capital fund. But instead of taking the bets like the player in the house where you're investing in 20 companies, 100 companies, whatever, it's about investing it in 2,000 companies so that you could just break even on that fund. But then giving that investor in exchange for participating in that fund warrants on your parent company stock, which is where all of the alpha should be coming from.
That's great. And I love your reference to the, I love your reference to what if, so what. Thanks for asking those two really key questions. That's great. Kudos. But I love the idea of the platform. And this is resonating with me because, we have a lot of customers that are trying to build products and become product oriented, specifically around digital products. But I think the platform idea is catching on. We're seeing that in legacy industries. I work a lot in automotive, and the physical platform of a car, that's kind of been the thing that's been around. But I was with an OEM last week, and it is walking into an OEM, an automotive OEM right now is it's like being in Silicon Valley and walking into, we know all the players, right? It is the mood, the feel, the look, the culture. That's definitely catching on, but I love the way you've added on to that. And I think that that marriage is really critical. I love the challenge that you put out there in the book. So one of the things, we love to ask one final question, what if, so what, but now what? So what can some of our listeners do about this right now after they read your book?
Well, step number one is to figure out what's core to your business. In a world like the last decade with low interest rates, low taxes, companies had the luxury to dabble around in all sorts of non-core things and invest their retained earnings, or the income that would have been retained earnings, into growth. But now that interest rates are higher and investors they could just put their money in the bank and generate returns, there's going to be more questions about what are you doing with our money? And to survive in this world, companies need to slim down. They need to cut expenses out of their business, and they need to focus on what they have the right to produce, which is their core products. You know, the market, when I mean the right, it's like, what do customers really think that you're going to build for them? And that's your core products. And if that's not good enough, and that's, you know, the core products aren't going to cut it, then a company needs to figure out what's going to be the new core product or core products and go all in on that and not worry about these non-core things that are generating demand. So that's the first step to take. That's a C-suite question. And that's, I think that's a question that's going on right now in a lot of boards. Okay, so once you have that cared for, then you have to figure out, what do you do with all the other great ideas that are not core? Do you set up an idea management software where your employees or your customers can submit ideas, like the Salesforce Idea Exchange? You want to collect that, right? You want to put that out there for this next step. And then the final step is to, once you have a place where you have those ideas that you want to fund, the next step is to set up a corporate venture capital fund, or I call it an ecosystem innovation fund, that behaves a lot more like a grant program than like corporate venture capital or even venture capital. Both corporate venture capital and venture capital, they all act like players in the innovation casino. They all invest large sums of money in a handful of companies, 20 companies or less for 6 out of 10 VC portfolios. But even if it's 100 companies, that's still player odds. So the key is to invest in 2,000 companies. So if you're in an industry like automotive, like telecom, there are a lot of larger companies that are within your supply chain that you can pool with. So the idea is, when you set up an innovation, an ecosystem innovation fund, you create rules, sort of like a government grant, like a SBIR grant, Small Business Innovation Research Grant. It's one of the most successful grant programs around. It's been around since the 80s. It's spawned things like 23andMe, Qualcomm, and they make investments right now. It's about up to $300K they give to startups. So not $1 million, you know, it's $300K. And it's all about checking the boxes of innovation criteria. Well, if you took that approach, but then applied it to venture capital where you're recouping your money, because it's not a grant, you're recouping your money, hopefully, with returns, you could fuse those ideas together to create rules that you and your large suppliers and distributors share. And in doing so, you only have to make 100 investments each and pool half of each investment with 20 other large firms to get to 2,000 investments. So setting up those rules, pooling them with your, yes. And you're seeing stuff like this start to happen in telecom with like one of those large suppliers, I won't name them, set up a telecom, a 5G innovation fund. They have carriers on there. They have equipment providers on there. Then they have like downstream software companies on there. But what if you could pool those investments together to get to 2,000? That's how you implement this approach.
Right, right. Pretty radical.
Pretty radical.
Isaiah, I think it's, but I think it's you've done the homework. I think you've built the models. I think you've looked at the history. I think it's intriguing. It's an innovation on innovation. Let's put it that way.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah. It's very, very, very meta. Isaiah, this is a great conversation. Thank you for coming on the show and taking the time today to explain it. There's a lot more in the book, Innovation Casino, and I look forward to talking to you guys again.
Thanks, Jim. It was great to be here.
You've been listening to What If, So What? A digital strategy podcast from Proficient with Jim Hertzfeld. We want to thank our Proficient colleagues, J.D. Norman and Rick Bauer, for our music. Subscribe to the podcast and don't miss a single episode. You can find this season, along with show notes, at proficient.com. Thanks for listening.